If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode. Hello, and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Today, we've got the latest episode in our new series on Britain's greatest prime ministers.
Hello, and welcome to our new series profiling some of Britain's most important prime ministers. I'm Matt Elton, deputy editor of BBC History Magazine. It's 300 years since Robert Walpole became Britain's first prime minister. To mark this seismic moment in the nation's political history, we asked a series of leading historians to each nominate the two leaders that they believe achieved most during their time in Number 10. Today we'll be hearing from historian and author Andrew Roberts, whose first choice is Robert Gascoigne Cecil, the third Marquess of Salisbury, who was prime minister three times during the late 19th century. So, the first question really is, I have to confess that I haven't heard very much of the Prime Minister that you've chosen here, which is Robert Gascoigne Cecil. Can you briefly set the scene as to who he was and when his time as Prime Minister fell?
Robert Gascoigne Cecil, the third Marquess of Salisbury, was Prime Minister three times, between 1885 and 86, then 1886 to 92, and then for the whole period from 1895 to 1902. So he was actually Prime Minister for longer than either Gladstone or Disraeli. And he was a titan, really, of the late Victorian period.
Do you think that Disraeli and Gladstone and how huge their reputation is has obscured the reputation of this person you've chosen?
Yes, Salisbury isn't that well known, and it seems extraordinary considering all his achievements. And the reason, I think, is because Gladstone and Disraeli are such enormous figures. They came just before him. He overlapped, of course, with both of them, but they came just before him, really, in their premierships. And as a result, because of their interaction, which was one of the great political duels of British history, he's been rather underestimated and left out, frankly.
Heading back towards the start of his life, to what extent did his early experiences shape his later political career?
His early experiences were absolutely essential to understanding him. He was an aristocrat, but he was a poverty-stricken one because his father disinherited him and fell out with him. And so he was forced into journalism, which, of course, for aristocrats in the 19th century was a hugely sort of almost embarrassing thing to have to write for journals. Yet it did force him to take on all the advantages of journalism in that he was able to master words, he was able to get concise thoughts down on paper successfully. He was in opposition for much of his life, which also was very good for the time that it came into government because he knew how he was going to be attacked. His route to becoming Prime Minister took him through the Secretary of State for India, which was a tremendously important department, needless to say, in the 19th century. And so, all in all, he had an absolutely ideal way to become Prime Minister, even though it didn't seem it at the time, especially being poverty-stricken, of course. And by poverty-stricken, of course, I say in a 19th century aristocratic way. I mean, he still had servants, for example.
And to what extent did his interpersonal relationships early on in his life shape how he viewed politics and democracy, even?
He had a fear of democracy, a terrible fear that the majority was going to basically disinherit the minority, and that they were going to use the working classes, essentially, were going to use sheer numbers to beggar everybody richer than themselves. This was his fear. He used to wake up at night terrified and sitting up having nightmares at the idea of democracy and the mob coming down the the long drive at Hatfield House. But of course, it wasn't to happen. But nonetheless, it did mean that he took decisions later on in his career to ensure that a good proportion of the working classes voted Tory.
We're obviously talking about a period of time which is quite removed from the present day political environment. To what extent was the office of Prime Minister comparable to what it's become today?
Lord Salisbury was not the kind of Prime Minister that you get in the 19th century at all. He very much saw the cabinet as being something that was a grand council of the nation. And so he was not interested in imposing his views on it. He actually managed to impose his view on it quite a lot, owing to the fact that he was an incredibly intelligent man, very witty, had tremendous foresight, and was a powerful personality. But he didn't impose it, his views on it in some kind of constitutional way, in the way really that the presidentialization of the office of Prime Minister allows modern day Prime Ministers to do.
And what challenges did he inherit when he came to office?
The major challenge, and the one that really kept him in office, frankly, for the whole of his premiership, was Irish Home Rule. And this is, of course, an issue that has very few real resonances in modern-day British politics, but it was the thing that completely dominated late Victorian politics, the idea that Ireland was going to rule itself rather than being ruled from Westminster. And he opposed that, and his opposition to it and the support of the old Whigs, who were the Liberal Unionists, who were Liberals but also opposed it, meant that he could stay in office for very long time, 13 and a half years.
And what were the qualities that he had as a person that allowed him to have this remarkable period in office?
As well as getting on very well with the leaders of the Liberal Unionists, Lord Hartington and Joseph Chamberlain, and so having the personal chemistry necessary for that, he was also a tremendous public speaker. Somebody who could keep huge crowds happy for hours and booming at them from the public podiums. And it was extraordinary. Of course, they had no microphones in those days. They absolutely just had to shout, really, and to shout for a full hour, making jokes about their enemy, political opponents, and sometimes making very profound, thoughtful comments to audiences of thousands in the pouring rain. It was a very different form of politics, of course, so he had that. He also, as I mentioned earlier, was a journalist, so he had this very pungent, acerbic written style. He had of course, in those days, with the lack of any kind of media apart from the Times newspaper, really, he had the ability to think in long form about the problems facing Britain and the Empire. And as I say, he was a highly intelligent, perhaps our most, along with, I would say possibly Gladstone, our most intelligent Prime Minister in terms of sheer, pure brain power. And as I say, he was also very witty. So all in all, he had a lot of advantages in becoming such an effective Prime Minister.
Would we recognise anything about that style of speechmaking today?
It would be very difficult to listen to one now, I think, because of the long sentences, the wonderful, you'd have several sub-clauses in the sentences. You would have a kind of upper-class voice that, frankly, outside Jacob Rees-Mogg, you don't get in politics much today as well. They certainly didn't believe in any kind of sort of social media soundbitey kind of politics either. And so I think it would be something that would be exhilarating to hear anybody speak like that again today. But we would find it very, very strange.
And if you had to somehow boil down his career as Prime Minister into three defining episodes, which episodes would you pick?
I think the first one has to be Irish Home Rule. You know, it went on, of course, long after his time in office, and it had started long before his time in office. But it was the moment in which he was able to, essentially to break the Liberal Party in the last quarter of the 19th century. Then the Queen's Jubilee, Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee in 1897 is extraordinary affair, the sort of height of empire in many ways in terms of the power and prestige of the British Empire. And he was prime minister during that and in many ways organised that. And then lastly, the Fashoda crisis of 1898, where we could have gone to war against the French because of a clash in the Upper Nile, showed the best of Salisbury's toughness, but also his capacity to keep the peace. And you see this again in the earlier, of course, 20 years earlier in the Congress of Berlin when he was Foreign Secretary. You see it when he was dealing with the Americans in 1888 over Venezuela that could have gone very badly wrong. And you see it also in the scramble for Africa and his deals basically with Otto von Bismarck. I think Fashoda sums up his peacemaking capacity, something that, of course, we desperately needed after he had left office.
And this was a period where there were a huge range of geopolitical powers battling it out and lots of tension on the international stage. How easy was it to navigate all of this, and what personal qualities did he bring to doing that?
It was tremendously difficult, of course, because diplomatically and dynastically, Europe was at each other's throats again and again. And you needed to ensure that a great European war never broke out, primarily, of course, another one post-1870 between Germany and France. And he felt that the best way of doing that was to keep all sides guessing about what Britain would do. So the negative side of that is what's called splendid isolation, which of course is connected to his name. But he certainly didn't see Britain as being isolated at all. He saw Britain as being a kind of honest broker between the various power blocks in Europe. And so he was viewed internationally with great respect by the French leaders, German leaders, Russian leaders, and so on. He also, of course, had to try to protect the British Empire from what was seen as Russian incursions in Afghanistan and Persia and northern India and so on. And so the way in which he dealt with this sort of ever-moving Rubik's Cube of European interests shows, I think, what an impressive statesman he was.
And it was under his leadership that Britain became more powerful than it had been before. Is that fair to say?
I think the power and prestige of Britain got to its absolute apogee under Lord Salisbury. And this was very much Lord Salisbury's intention. He didn't, in fact, annex that amount of territory, Burma, but not huge amounts in the way that his predecessors had. But he certainly hung on to everything, and he recaptured Sudan in the River War. But he also got involved in the Boer War at the end of his career, which, although we won it, of course, was a little like the British Empire's Vietnam, frankly. But even taking that into account, the British Empire under him got to its not its largest territorial size, because that happened after the First World War, but certainly in terms of power and prestige and what Britain could do, it got to its height under Lord Salisbury.
What were his flaws? What were his major weaknesses, I suppose?
Well, it's the same flaw, really, that an awful lot of prime ministers have, in that he didn't really grow his successor. Somebody who's been in power a very long time, and you see this again and again in prime ministers. You see this with Margaret Thatcher to an extent, you see it with Tony Blair, you certainly see it with others, is that the successor, Winston Churchill, it's also true, is the successor is not a great success themselves. Partly this is, of course, just because there's an ennui in the electorate. You know, they've got bored of the same party after 13 years or so. But nonetheless, I think it's the duty of a prime minister to try to bring on a good successor. And with Salisbury, he was understandably accused of appalling nepotism because his successor was Arthur Balfour, who was his nephew. And so I think it was a flaw to... you can understand totally how an aristocrat might want his own nephew to take over as prime minister. It was a very sort of 19th century, 18th century, in fact, concept. But nonetheless, it was a flaw.
And was there an episode that tarnished his reputation, or that has subsequently come to tarnish his image, I suppose?
I think the tarnishing of his image really does come with the Boer War, not least, of course, by the introduction of concentration camps, which were not in any way intended to be the kind of extermination camps that the Nazis had. In fact, the exact opposite. They were attempting to protect the Boer women and children by taking them off the veldt and away from the war. But nonetheless, needless to say, if your premiership is in any way connected with something like concentration camps, that's going to be very easy for people, detractors, to misinterpret what's going on.
Are there any lessons from this story for the politics of the 21st century, do you think?
I think there are some lessons in that statesmanship is never going to be at a discount. It's always going to be important to have people who have a wide sort of global attitude towards solving problems, which Lord Salisbury certainly did. He kept defence high, of course. In fact, it was under him that we had the two power standard, whereby the Royal Navy had to be, by law, larger than the next two navies in the world combined, which is an extraordinary thing when one comes to think of it, but something that the Victorians were able to pay for.
And if you were to create some sort of ultimate prime minister, what features or facets or abilities do you think this particular example could contribute?
I think Lord Salisbury would make a great identikit prime minister, were there such a thing, because of his high intelligence, because of his wit. He was also generally good-humoured. He doesn't have the reputation necessarily of being jolly, but nonetheless, he was a good person. And he had this tremendous foresight and this hatred of war. And I think those two are very important things in any prime minister.
Finally, then, if you could ask him a question, what question would you ask?
Assuming I'm allowed to ask him a question and he knows what's happened since his death, which is, I think the important thing when one has these completely diverting parlour games like this one, is to ask him about what he would have done to have averted the First World War. Were he 10 years younger, if he'd lived 10 years longer, he would have been in a position to have been the pretty much key decision maker in Europe, along with the Kaiser, about whether the First World War breaks out, and if so, under what circumstances. And I think that if he were up in heaven looking down and seeing the events of August 1914, I would love to know what was going through his mind in how that could have been avoided.
And finally, we should see him on the same sort of level, the same sort of plane as Disraeli and Gladstone.
I would actually put Lord Salisbury on a higher plane than either Disraeli or Gladstone. I think that one of the duties of a prime minister is to try to advance the power and prestige of the country of which you're prime minister. And Lord Salisbury did that far more successfully, actually, than either Benjamin Disraeli or William Gladstone.
Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. Tune in tomorrow when John Higgs will be telling us about the extraordinary poet and painter William Blake.